I think this is a...
Song of Gold, a time yeah. washed midnight away.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, this is totally recording.
Oh, God.
More.
I must be dreaming. I'm tired. How are you?
Sorry. You start.
So, good evening. Welcome to September's edition of Dan Now Backwards. You're listening to Gareth Edgley, your usual host, and Sarah Wesson.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the show. So, this month's show, we have our presenter's challenge is set by Gaz here. Coming up, a bit of a review of what we've been up to for summer. We've had a month off, haven't we?
Yeah, long summer. What we've... August and stuff.
Yeah, August is a long month.
We're going to have a presenter's challenge, which is something borrowed, which is going to be coming up later, about books and the joys of secondhand book ownership and passing them on. So, starting off, I guess, Sarah, what have you been up to?
Quite recently, I've been reading lots, actually, on the theme of the book night, so that's good.
Anything of note?
I've been reading a book that was given to me on World Book Night by one of our sort of captain and co-presenter, Ellen Morgan, who's unfortunately not with us tonight, but... That was A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mystery.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I've now passed that on to Jess, who we'll probably be hearing from a bit later about borrowed books that she's been reading. I also read White Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
There's another one. But anyway, we'll be chatting about that in the presenter's challenge bit later on. Last weekend was open house weekend.
Of course, the architectural open day when members of the public can get to go around buildings which otherwise the rest of the year they can't get access to.
Yeah, they have hundreds, maybe even thousands of buildings that are open and some tours and exhibitions. And yeah, I always mean to be a bit more organised and plan it and book things in advance. Like the BT Tower is always open, but you have to do it by ballot.
I guess so, that's a popular one.
Yeah, you have to apply months in advance and stuff, so a lot of the cool stuff is taken up. But then at the same time, you end up just going somewhere and you can look in the guide and go to something nearby. And like, we ended up going to Hoxton Music Hall,
which
I didn't even know was there, but they had like a guy playing piano and this old lady like all dressed up like a Victorian vaudeville sort of thing, singing these like Knees Up Mother Brown style songs and all the All I Need a Day Is My Half Pint of Beer. And yeah, so that was quite random. We've gone to see something else we can get into and stumbled across that.
I think so.
It's always really, that's got to be open minded on open house weekend, I think. Open to what comes your way.
Yeah, admittedly, I have. I ended up going around the Hoover Building in West London, which is now a Tesco's, but above
That's a really beautiful building. Is that Art Deco building?
Yeah, it is that one, yeah. It's now owned, at the time it was owned by a cigarette company, and it's really strange because it's just before, a couple of years before the ban, and they had ashtrays everywhere, like a sort of, not bring your kid to work, but bring your cigarette habit to work. I'm sure there were freebies in the office shop, but but the building itself was a facade, alas, because the rest of it was sold off to Tesco years before, after Hoover's crash, after the infamous Air Miles scam, which rinsed them out.
Yeah, of course.
So the whole back of the building's now a Tesco supermarket. And the facade remains because I'm sure it's listed. And it's an absolutely lovely, sort of iconic building, especially if you're going down the A40
on the way to town. Yeah, on the way out of London.
Yeah,
On the way west.
Into the building.
Cool.
But the one to go to, actually, next year, if you're going to book this, because it is, it's the weekend of the, what would that be, the 19th?
It's usually around the 16th, 17th of September. It's always that middle of the month in September, sort of the closest weekend to it. It's worth trying to plan in advance and getting to the things that you want to see.
Yeah, I think definitely put yourself down now for the ballot for the BBC Tower. I believe the Barbican are open where they show flats.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would be amazing, not to see Hadrian Half live, but, you know, cause it's, but it's still, it's an absolutely classic sort of brutalist piece of architecture that I'd love to see close up. But the other one, personally, I'd like to see is Churchill's bunker in Neasden, which...
I didn't make it that far this year. We did quite a lot of stuff, but it was all around the East End, really, which is nice as well, so you get to know your own area and see things that you don't normally know about. But I remember one year going to North Point in Highgate.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Lebekhin building who also did the penguin enclosure at London Zoo. So it's all sort of like stark white, like modernist, like really beautiful. And they have his penthouse on the top floor and they opened it with like tours and you can go in. But they had like all his original furniture in there, like Eames chairs, like everything, all the classic like modernist furniture. They had it how he had it when he lived there.
So is
it's
this,
really awesome. And the view from the top as well. So you're at the very top of Highgate on something like the 9th floor or the 11th floor, and you can see for miles. It's really, yeah.
And is it in private ownership for the rest of the year, or is it just a sort of a National Trust building by this point?
I think it's privately owned, actually. I think it is some architect. He's, you know, he's got a lot of money and real passion for that kind of design, so he's, like, maintained it like that. But, yeah, they also, you can do tours around other flats in the building and they talk you through the way the communal spaces are designed things. It's well worth looking out for. Also this year, we went to the Accumulator Tower in Limehouse Marina, which we just wanted to go and see because it sounds so bizarre. We were thinking, well, what's, you know,
what accumulating what? Accumulating wealth? Like, given its,
actually, it's this
distance and Canary Wharf and stuff.
It's a 19th century brick octagonal tower, and it was a hydraulic system, like steam engine powered, because it's on the marina, so it would operate the cranes and the locks and everything. It was like a hydraulic system for all that, and it was actually really interesting. Just the sort of science behind it and the engineering. It was quite, interesting. And the people there really knew what they were talking about. And you can go to the top and you can see right across East London from the top because it's quite tall.
Yeah, I imagine.
And it's right on the DLR line as well, so you see the trains going past this, yeah.
So can you actually see it from the DLR if you're going out there on a sort of daily basis? Or?
And I'd never noticed it before, but then I looked today and I saw it. So, it's kind of blends in around there because a lot of... It's quite built up.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the beauties of the open house thing, that it just let you get into places that you wouldn't otherwise get access to. Sorry, pardon my Winnie Pops. Yes, I've...
been drinking beer tonight because there's no wine in the shop.
Yeah, actually, we're broadcasting from Poplar and stuff. I have just been into a shop that's pretty much a front for...
depths of the East End of London.
Yeah, I'm not going to name the shop for not wanting to get done by whatever mafia is supporting it, but seemingly it's got to be a front for some sort of trade that escapes me in its illegality.
I think that might be libel. I don't know if we can say that.
That's why I'm not going to mention its name. But let's just say...
it wasn't in the open house weekend anyway.
No, where I was going with this. But, yeah.
Yeah, it was quite nice actually because the day we went to the Accumulator Tower, we were walking and it had been really nice all day. We were in t-shirts in the morning and it started pouring down with rain and we were looking for this place. We didn't know where it was. And we got there and we climbed to the top of this thing and it stopped raining and a rainbow came out. It was a cheesy moment, but it was nice. It was worth the climb up. And then on the Sunday, I'd gone down to the community boat that some guys, Al of Metro Acoustics, who's... sort of a friend of the show, is involved with this boat that they're hiring out as like a venue. Got a licensed bar on board and everything, but also they're using the funds to have workshops on board the boat and to sort of get kids involved and get them involved in maintenance and sort of looking, you know, being involved working with the boat. So
I think, yeah.
It's quite an interesting project. We have got a website to tweet later, but there's not a lot of information on it at the moment, but I think that it's quite early days for them, and it's definitely worth keeping an eye on what's going on with them.
Well, any sort of grassroots thing, yeah, needs support, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, like I said, we'll be tweeting links to that later on. Yeah.
So, Gaz, what have you been up to?
I've been catching up on a lot of film, because it's been summer and stuff, and there has been a lot of blockbusters out over the summer.
Because that's what you want to do in the summer, is go and sit inside a cinema.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's been a bit of a crap summer, and it has been sort of in the evening, so I wouldn't waste the daylight hours, like, you know, to... Why would you? But, you know... I've managed to catch up on all the sort of hits, as it were, and it's been pretty ropey as a year. I mean, apparently more money was taken this year than in recent years, but then you can say that's down to sort of the price of tickets, especially like 3D films, where you had sort of big sort of tentpole blockbusters like Transformers, which was in 3D. And they can charge a premium for that if you go for it.
It could be more like £15.
Yeah, especially in central London, where we're sort of, pretty much like anything you want to see, even like sort of Greater London, when you're going to go to the cinema, it's all quite expensive, which I guess would be probably more problematic if you can go with a family. But,
were you saying earlier about this thing that you see, you pay a certain amount? And you can,
Cineworld.
That's worth doing. Yeah,
that's the thing. That Cineworld card. Apparently, this isn't that we're going to get a plug for it, and we're sort of getting paved backs
we're
for
after
it.
It. Actually, it's unless the Cineworld cards, unless Cineworld want to send this, Cineworld.
But yeah, of course, because we're always up for. Well, no, not at all. We do it for love, but it's a really, really good deal. If you go see two films a month, then you're going to pay for the card already. But it pretty much.
And you'd want to go. It'd make me go more, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do go a lot because I've got a friend, actually a friend of the show, Matthew Simpson, who's been on a few months ago. I go along with him. Of course, he gets it for free. I then sort of pay like a mug. But I have seen a lot of stuff, even things that I wouldn't normally have gone to see, like Transformers, admittedly, just because Matt goes to cinema an awful lot because of this card. So he gets real value for money for it. But so I've seen... So of the recent stuff, especially British films, I saw the Inbetweeners movie.
Oh, really? See, I still haven't seen that. I do want to see it, though.
Yeah, admittedly, I find the sort of awkward comedy a bit too sort of awkward for me. I do have problems with Curb, actually.
Yeah,
I
know you're a big fan of Curb. We were talking about this before, weren't we? But it's just too cringeworthy.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I can watch it, but it's that thing of. I also found The Office as well, that it's too. So it's so close to the bone.
I never got into The Office. Big Curb fan.
It's more anything that's the sort of the main protagonist sets out to do something that makes them look absolutely awful. It's really funny to watch, but at the same time, I empathise too much, perhaps. I'm like, And there is a lot of that in the Inbetweeners. And I've not seen much of the TV series at all, like maybe in a few episodes here or there, because I've not had the time to sort of sit down over maybe a box set or whatever. It should probably be the best way to watch it these
days.
Yeah,
I've watched the odd one here and there, I think.
But I was quite reluctant going in because I thought it would just be a sort of Kevin and Perry go large type thing, which I've never been able to sit all the way through because I just thought it was absolute shite. But this was a genuinely funny sort of British coming of age film that was so awkward. It was unbelievable. I don't want to give anything away, but there are some utter scenes of like, I want to rip up my eyes because it's just too cringeworthy and stuff. But it got a lot of laughs, and it's very sort of it's a very sweet film.
I think that's all part of it is worth the if people are laughing and they're into it then. So that's the nice thing about going to the cinema. I think it's that shared experience.
But other ones I've seen, Hannah. I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
No, I've not heard that.
So Hannah's Joe Wright, who did the Ian McEwan adaptation, which name escapes me. But it, yeah, Keira Knightley, the guy out of Sugar. I forget his name. It's really, really awful. But anyway, Joe Wright, he's a sort of, he does sort of modern day Merchant Ivory films, so period pieces, that sort of like.
Okay, yeah.
And he did an action film set in Europe, soundtracked by the Chemical Brothers, and it's basically a fairy tale. It's about a young girl who is a kick ass assassin, which I bought into totally because I loved Leon. I absolutely loved Leon. Uh-huh. Yeah. So
that's a great film.
I mean, again, so it's got that, as with Leon, European sensibility, but an action film. So it's very sort of knowing of its the tropes of an action film in that sort of vein. But yeah, she's up against the. She's basically raised by a father in the wilderness in the Arctic Circle, and he's an ex special agent. And then she goes back into the world to try and kill his former handler, who is the Wicked Witch piece. Uh-huh. But it's every sort of Hansel and Gretel type fairy tale thing you can think of. It's quite heavy-handed in its way, but it's really, really good. And it's got a great cast, like absolutely brilliant cast, and an absolutely thumping soundtrack that really, really set the scene. But it was really sort of... it drove the scene as well, like all the. And it was a really, really good film, and I'd definitely recommend it anyway. I think it's out on video and DVD and Blu-ray now.
Excellent.
But other than that, I got to see Thor, which is a new Marvel comic book adaptation of the Thor sort of superhero.
Oh, that sounds quite cool.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh directed. So, Kenneth Branagh. You know it's going to be classy, even though the material is probably a bit sort of like lowbrow and stuff. And it was genuinely fun, really, really good fun, because it's very knowing in the fact that, like, for this guy, he's some god, Nordic god dropped on Earth. And he's just like, Liege, get me a horse, and all this sort of stuff. And they're like, it's a pet shop, we sell cats and dogs. So it's very, very sort of tongue-in-cheek, and not camp, but not even kitsch, but sort of, it has a humour to it.
Okay.
Playing on the fact that, like, you know, these things are really quite self, usually quite self-important and stuff, or earnest or whatever, and it isn't at all. And I really, really, really enjoyed it. I didn't think I would, but yeah, it was... stupidly good fun. And other than that, I saw the best film of the summer for me, though, was Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, I've heard good things about that, actually. Jess, who might be joining us later, she went to see it and she said it was really good.
Yeah.
I think I watched the very original Planet of the Apes, but like when I was a kid or something, I don't really remember it. But,
so did you not see the Tim Burton version of it at all?
No, I haven't. I'd like to see it because it's the one where he met Helena Bonham Carter, wasn't it? And I always quite like that idea of him falling in love with her while she's in monkey makeup.
Crikey, yeah, because I thought that was much earlier. I thought that was going to be Sleepy Hollow. But yeah, that's one of the criticisms that I have of that film was that she was, just Helena Bonham Carter. Uh-huh. In monkey makeup, and you could just tell it was Helen Carter. It was quite ridiculous, and and the rest of the films. I do have a certain love for them, but I think at the same time, Charlton Heston's probably a bit of a dick.
And can you say that?
Yeah, well, I do. Well, no more. It's that thing of it's the personality on screen and the off screen stuff, and it all bleeds in. But I think when you got some NRA guy, you know. You can get my rifle off me when you prize it out of my cold dead hands, you know. He's a bit right wing, really, in a way that I'm not comfortable with. A bit wrong. Well, yeah, like, you know, it's that thing of you know, he's a hero to some for his films of the 60s and 70s and stuff. But yeah, I enjoy his if you want to call it art or whatever, his you know, productions and stuff, but. As a person, yeah, not so much. So with this new Planet of the Apes film, it actually does some really, really nice touches that it sort of harks back to his you know, his version of the film. The odd line here and there, of course, obviously the "get your hands off me, you goddamn dirty apes" thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
But also where the sort of characters in the films are watching the TV, and it's showing The Robe, which was one of Charlton Heston's films.
Oh, right.
And so it's nice, that sort of meta sort of aspect to it. But it's a really, really intelligent film. It's an English guy directing it. It had no sort of expectations. Everyone thought like it would just be a piece of crap that, you know, exploiting the sort of mythology of some well-established films and not really going to be original. But having seen it, it really does do its own thing. It sets up sequels in a really, really good way. Not the ending, which I'm not going to give the ending away, but stay for the end credits, definitely, because they're quite sort of mind-blowing. And what happens in the end credits is really haunting in its own way. But it's more that you've got sort of stuff that at one point in the film, it's a throwaway line, some spaceship's just taken off to go to Mars. And then, without giving anything away, you know it's a Planet of the Apes film, so basically it's called Rise of the Planet of the Apes, so it means that humanity is going to be fucked at some point, and that does happen. But in that time, you've got these people who've gone to Mars, so you know that that's in the sequel. My prediction, they're going to come back to find the Earth gone, and that'll be the set start for the equivalent of the Charlton Heston film.
So it leaves it open.
Yeah, but the effects and stuff are amazing, and it's one of those you really, really do empathise with the ape character, Caesar. It's that sort of next generation sort of motion capture that they've sort of been doing since sort of Avatar and stuff. And everyone bought into it. Everyone in the cinema that I saw laughed at the right bits because it is funny, but sort of, grimaced audibly. Mm. Like people are, ooh,
oh, really?
Bits.
Oh,
because,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it really, really sets it up that the apes are sort of, holier than thou, and the humans in the film are just all pretty sort of wrong because they all have their own sort of motivations and stuff that's quite self-serving. And it's a really, really good film. And I'd say it's, like I said, the best film of the summer for me.
Oh, that's quite an accolade.
Yeah. And other than that, I have seen some real crap.
always.
Shit film for the summer. One that I would recommend people see just to see how cheesy a film could be is Battle LA.
Battle LA?
It's an alien invasion flick that some aliens who have invaded the planet to steal our water. They've taken out London, they've taken out Paris, they've taken out Tokyo. But LA won't fall. This is where we fight back, of course. And
feel-good patriotic film.
Yeah, and it's all the sort of cheesiest sort of stereotypes you could think of. So you've got like the CEO, commanding officer, who has lost his previous platoon in some war-type environment. Mm. So no one trusts him, and he fights back and earns the trust of everybody. And people die along the way, really heroic deaths and slow-mo and stuff, and they've spent a lot of money on it, but it still looks very cheap, and it just didn't really do it. I know.
But you say it's worth a watch?
It's definitely worth a watch in a sort of mindless kind of way. I mean, you're going to it with no expectations, and none of them will be met because it doesn't exceed in any area, really, from effects to story to anything other than cheesiness.
Okay.
If you like cheesiness, if you want to definitely. I mean, I wouldn't even say it's a good Friday night film. It isn't. It's a probably good post-pub film when you just want to see mindless stuff, not even have to pay attention to the storyline, because there is no storyline.
Mm.
It's the first 15 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, but for about 2 hours, but not as good.
Oh, you're really selling it.
But with aliens. And yeah. That's my my film roundup. Oh, sorry, did I mention Transformers 3? About the sort of... Yeah, I did mention price of cinema tickets.
I don't know.
Yeah, don't see it. Don't.
What did we watch the other day? That Troll Hunter.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That was great.
Yeah.
I really liked that. It's kind of a Blair Witch style, done like it's like a documentary or found footage.
Found footage, of course.
Of these guys who are, it starts off, you think they're looking into like illegal bear hunters, but it turns out this guy that they're kind of tracking, he's a troll hunter, and it really weaves in the whole that Nordic fairy tale of like trolls living under bridges and. Yeah. It really creates a world, doesn't it? This really believable world where trolls exist and this guy hunts them. And it's probably not one to watch for your tire because it's in Norwegian with subtitles.
Yeah.
But it's shot beautifully as well, like really sort of faithful, but the landscape is just stunning.
Yes,
really
it is.
Beautiful, like mountains and.
Yeah, it's shot on HD video. So it's that mockumentary sort of feel. It does it really well. So it doesn't actually have the sort of, it doesn't have the filmic sheen, but that sort of plays really well into the sort of special effects, which aren't sort of, cutting edge, but are good enough when you've got it just as crap sort of HD video that they're completely passable.
Yeah, really beautiful.
And as you're saying, the world building, every aspect of it is... They're throwing away lines left, right, and centre, just completely, like I say, throw away. Sort of things like, the power lines that we build through the mountains, that's because it keeps them in. They're repulsed by the power and stuff. And just little things like that. They pass a container at one point that's been bashed up, and trolls were here. And, it's a really, really good sort of found footage Blair Witch update. With some, I genuinely thought the special effects are great.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done.
Really, really sort of fitting. And
I really got into that film.
Funny though as well.
Is it out in the cinema at the moment?
It is in the cinema now, but at this point it's going to be your sort of art house films. Cineworld that we mentioned before, I doubt it's playing in Cineworld at this point. But if you can get to independent cinema, so... I guess anyway in central London, maybe the Rio in sort of Dawson might be playing it, or like the Film House in
Curzon.
Yeah.
Yeah, places like that. Prince Charles maybe sometimes. But they tend to play stuff a lot later, I think.
But it's one of those, it's a surprise hit of the summer. And also equally of merit the fact that the budget is clearly sort of it would have been done for absolute peanuts. But it's one of the films that's so strong that it's bound to get a really bad American remake at some point. Not to diss American remakes, because, Let the Right One In, which is another sort of Scandinavian film that had this whole remake business.
See, I don't think I saw the remake of that.
I didn't, but I've heard very, very good things. And I like the director of it, because I did like Cloverfield. So he's got his sort of indie sensibilities to him, even though, ostensibly it's not really... it's not... really an indie film. It just has the techniques of it, but it's very, very very, very original and very funny and very sort of thought-provoking. Is the whole thing in it is the troll hunter says to this camera crew following him, I hope none of you are Christians, and of course it's that thing of faith, what about faith? And at one point they pick up this camera person and they say, are you a Christian? She goes, no, I'm a Muslim. So, well, how's that stand? Like, would the trolls go for it because she's a Muslim? Because how's it stand when the original troll mythology was, Christians and stuff? And it's really, really well thought out. They don't miss a trick at any level, any step.
Yeah, excellent film. So we'll be tweeting a link to that later as well. Everything we talk about tonight, there'll be links on Twitter.
But do you have anything coming up? Do you want to see anything that's caught your eye?
Should we do that at the end?
Oh, we could do,
I think we've got a few things to mention that are coming up.
Well, I've got one film that I'd like to recommend that will segue into our
presenter's challenge. Nice, we like a good segue.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Okay, yeah, I've seen posters for that. I'd quite like to see that.
It's a John le Carré adaptation done by the guy who did Let the Right One In, the original sort of Swedish one. Mm. And apparently it's getting rave reviews. I've not had a chance to see it yet because at this point in time I've not had a chance to get to the cinema. But I've heard nothing but good things. plus Gary Oldman.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And stepping into Alec Guinness's shoes.
Uh-huh.
And I hope that he does a good job, because George Smiley is a very, very sort of seminal character in the sort of whole spy genre. But of course, so adaptation of a book. And this is where we're going. So it's something borrowed, really. In this case, borrowed story and stuff. But this is about the joys of secondhand books.
Uh-huh. I think it's quite a universal thing, isn't it? That, people give you books, or often as well, books you are found, and which is something the Guardian's doing at the moment as well, that we're going to mention.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, they're going to be dumping books in various places. keep track of dumping
books by the truckload.
Yeah, that's it. They're not burning them, thank God, but they will be. The Guardian's basically
in the Midwest.
The Guardian's going to be doing a sort of, promotion soon, that they're going to be sort of dropping off books that people can pick up and pass around and that sort of like. And it sort of ties into this, that the joys of being, lent books or finding books or borrowing books of friends that, you might not necessarily have thought to get yourself, but one of your friends is really, really into it. From a point of view that they want to then chat to you about it, and the sort of whole community that you can get around sort of novels and things.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the sort of fan base you might get around a novel, like the sort of, say, the Twilight thing, and especially the films and stuff, but,
But this thing that The Guardian's doing, and we'll get more details of that later, we'll be tweeting a link to the website as well, but... it reminds me a lot of the World Book Night thing that happened a while ago, where people gave out a certain number of books, and I'm not sure about the Guardian scheme, but they each had a unique number in them that you could track on a website, and I think that as well, that is using the internet to open up that sense of having something to talk about. And it's like the popularity of book clubs and reading clubs coming back as well, and it's really good.
I do give this actually in Stoke Newington in Hackney, when you have the sort of Stoke Newington Festival, they always have secondhand bookstores, and I love the fact that you can pick up a book that will have sort of library card sort of stamped into it, and so it's completely secondhand. Actually, it's probably been through more than two hands at some point. And you look at a publishing date, and it'll be at some point in the '70s and stuff. And I like the fact that it would have been read by so many people, and they always smell a bit musty and stuff. And not necessarily like it's bad to pick up a dog-eared book, and I'll probably like not get it if it's falling apart. But I like, especially when there's inscriptions within them.
Or you find something someone's used as a bookmark and things.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, should I introduce, we've got another guest in the studio tonight, Rabia, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Rabia.
Hiya.
So, on the theme of something borrowed and things, because I know I've borrowed books a few before. I remember reading Mr. Nice.
Yeah.
Which I borrowed from you, and that was really good. I still haven't seen the film.
I haven't seen the film either.
It's who's that guy in it?
It's Reese Evans.
Reese Evans, that's it.
Howard Marks.
I think I would like to see the film though, because I really enjoyed the book.
Well, I also the director of the film, Bernard Rose, is a really underrated, and he hasn't actually put much out, but he's a great director. I don't know if you've seen films like Paper House.
No.
It was a really, really creepy English horror film from the 80s that I'm not sure if you actually get it these days. It might be on Amazon, and if it is, I'd definitely recommend checking it out. He also did the American film Candyman, which again is quite sort of...
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's really, it's a really, really good sort of contemporary horror film. But mainly it's elevated by a Philip Glass score that is just so sort of, it embeds itself in your head that it's terrifying. But Mr. Nice. Did you read Mrs. Nice?
No. No, didn't know that.
Mrs. Nice, Mrs. Nice was written by his wife.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that existed.
That's quite interesting. Yeah, I've not heard of that either.
Yeah, I'll have to lend it you at some point, but it's pretty much that his wife's perception of the world while he was inside and their sort of lifestyle and stuff.
Yeah.
There's also Senor Nice, which is a book he did afterwards about what he got up to. But to be fair, that one seemed to be a bit too name-droppy. At one point, at the start of the book, he's like, oh, so I was just getting on a train at Paddington and Gruff Reese, the lead singer of the Super Fairy Animals, was in my carriage and we were chatting away because we're good mates. And I thought, a bit name-droppy here.
I'd want to be his mate, though.
Yeah. I remember meeting him at the Green March years ago in Brixton, in Brockwell Park?
Oh, yeah.
And somehow I'd ended up working in the Greenpeace tent and made a load of curry.
I believe I worked there as well, actually. Of course.
And he was talking in the Greenpeace tent. He came over afterwards and he had some curry. But I was trying to skin up at the same time. it's the Green March, it's Howard Marks, but it wasn't fast enough.
Well, to quote Super Fairy's lyric, Super Fairies, you and me and the guy from Sparks all getting high with Howard Marks. Of course.
I met Goldie Looking Chain once at my May Ball at the university and had a bit of chat with those guys, the good hoot. But one of them, I think he's called Short Term, he's relating a few anecdotes at Howard Marks's house and what they got up to.
Oh, yeah.
How he's like on his kitchen floor for a weekend. But he does sound like he could throw a good party.
Yeah.
He's keeping the Welsh connections, he's got the Welsh connection going on, so.
Yeah, of course. Again, sort of God Looking Chain, again, to drop the Super Fairy Animals in there, they were touring with them. I've seen them probably, three or four times at least, when I've been following the Super Fairy Animals and stuff. And it's, always good fun. Equally, I've seen Howard Marks at the sort of Super Fairies did a gig at the Royal Festival Hall, where they took it over for an evening, and they had Howard Marks in a confessional box, where people would go in and see one box, Howard Marks would be in the other, and they'd be like, mate, I've got problems with my girlfriend, and Howard Marks like, women, tricky question. Great, really, really great sort of seeing, sort of people getting advice from Howard Marks.
Yeah.
And, like he's some sort of priest taking their confession or whatever. But yeah, good guy.
Yeah, no, I'll have to check out that movie. I think it translates well it's such an action-packed. And also I think when, films like follow someone's life over, biopics that go over a certain... timeline, it's always interesting, translates well to the
visual. Yeah, I think as well, because when I was reading that book, I could visualise it really well, and I think that always makes for a good film as well.
Mm.
They paint the picture very well.
Yeah, especially for any audience member who hasn't read it, and let's face it, that would be a sort of minimal number, I'm guessing, because... like a belly button, I think everyone's got a copy of it. it's one of those. He has such a crazy life. He's a double agent at some point and stuff, and hired by MI6, doing all this business and crazy life.
Yeah.
If you smoked weed in the '80s, you could thank Howard.
Oh, pretty much.
Most
yeah.
likely, yeah. Yeah. So. But yeah, no, it's very interesting tales. And yeah, I have to check out the movie. Yeah. He's got a collection of short stories actually called The Book of Dope Stories.
Oh, and
I tried to, it's all right. It's nothing like as good as Mr. Nice. I found that because it's obviously still autobiographical, but they're a little more anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I haven't found that as easy to get into.
Does anyone know if it was ghostwritten at all?
The Book of Dope Stories.
I
think he wrote them because, he's...
I know he's an Oxford graduate.
Yeah, and he was also, when he was in prison, wasn't he, working, writing letters for prisoners and sort of helping... He taught himself law and everything. And I think he's quite a literary person. I can imagine him writing it himself.
Maybe
I just want to believe that.
Yeah, I was thinking, because one that I've been reading over summer was Renegade, Mark E. Smith from the Falls.
Oh, yeah.
Biography, but I don't want to say autobiography because I know it was ghostwritten.
And Katie Price style.
Well, I think he's probably had, I think Katie Price, she'll say outright that, you know, someone else wrote it, I was putting my name on it. Whereas, you know, that's fiction, whereas, because hers is.
Right, yeah.
Whereas this, it's ridiculously, it's very well written. And it's all the stuff out of his life, but imagine he's just like pouring out his story to some guy while he's, you know, necking loads of speed and drinking loads of whiskey. Because that's the way he rolls in the book. But it's ridiculously funny. It's the funniest book I've ever read because, of course, he's had a lot of members in the Fall, and every one of them he slates.
He's alienated, yeah.
Yeah, so everyone's like, oh, yeah, he was a good drummer.
In fact, there's that book, isn't there, that... I sort of had a flick through in a bookshop once, so I won't claim to have read it. But it's I Was in the Fall, it's called. We'll look that up.
Oh, he mentions it. Yeah, he does mention it.
And this journalist basically tracked down everyone who'd been in the Fall. And it's not a small book, you know. There's sort of, you know, a lot of people who've been in the Fall, and maybe they just did one gig and pissed Mark E. Smith off, or... I don't know, it just didn't work out, or if they were there. They've been going a long time, though, the band.
So. Yeah, of course, since late 70s.
But, yeah, this guy tracked them all down, and sort of got their stories, what they were doing now, and along that sort of line.
Oh, he sort of, he designates a whole sort of section of the book just to slating that book and stuff. It's amazing. It's the most bile-filled, vitriolic sort of rant ever, and he has no time for anyone that's not fucked him over, because, you know, by all means, he says, like, oh, you know, these people, it's like, you know, footballers and stuff, they complain about their lives, yet they're sort of multimillionaires and blah, blah, blah. If you're in the Fall, this is how we roll, you know. They couldn't hack it, so they sort of left the tour, mid-tour. How could they? Oh, they got to some girlfriends, didn't they? And they couldn't hack it anymore, because the girls were wailing in their ears. And, he's... not a spiteful person, just very, very, very vitriolic towards any sort of ex-member.
Some of the, like, most memorable books that I've been lent or been given to read that I'd never pick up myself are biographies. three that I can remember is The Mod Father, which is kind of weird. It's actually... this guy who was really into the Jam and his obsession with Paul Weller, and it's basically all about Paul Weller and like his career, but like it's told through the story of this guy who's just obsessed with Paul Weller.
Stalker.
Basically, yeah. and also someone lent me the Motley Crue biography, which is their story told by each member, but the stories overlap, so you get the same story, really, but the different really perspectives on it. It's really compelling reading, and I find that with biographies, I mean, I'm very select about them, I don't read them that often, but they do tend to be the books that I can't put down. The other one that was like that was Slash from Guns N' Roses. That was also a very compelling read, and I got through that in a couple of days, I think.
See, I'll take your Slash and raise you one John Lydon. Johnny Rotten.
Okay.
Yeah, his autobiography, No Blacks, No Irish, No Dogs, is, I'd say, essential reading. It's just so funny. But in a similar sort of way as this Motley Crue book, he has a load of contemporaries at the time. So you've got, like, Billy Idol and stuff, and sort of other sort of people on the sort of punk scene, telling it as it was for them. And he says that in the start of the book, he has a disclaimer. He says, look, you know, there's going to be a lot of opinions in here that differ to mine. And this whole story is a differ. And it's just like, wow. But it's really, really good. And, you know, it just sort of tells it from his point of view. And whether or not he's up his own arse, well, he's likable enough in the book that, you know, you can sort of bypass all his butter adverts and stuff. And you can probably see that why he did that, just to get money so he can go back on tour.
Well, it's like Iggy Pop as well, isn't it? And his car insurance. Insurance company don't actually insure you if you're self-employed or a musician, so you can get insurance with them. Seems a little bit odd, but...
Well, all of these, I mean, sort of, certainly Iggy Pop. But Iggy Pop's... his hits were written...
there was one.
But his hits were written by David Bowie, so going off on this tangent about Iggy Pop. Like, David Bowie would do stuff for him in the 80s, like produce sort of the album that had Wild War on it.
Is it a David Bowie autobiography, or biography even? I'd quite like to read his biography, I think.
Yeah, I'd love to read that.
I bet he's got some wild stories.
Maybe you can borrow it from someone.
Definitely.
Any listeners out there who can fill us in, call the show. It's, what's the number? 0845
Ask for Sarah. But I'm guessing, I'd like to know more actually about sort of the whole Zoe Bowie, Duncan Jones thing.
Oh, and him changing his name.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I give this because as a child, my mother had changes on the record player pretty much all the time. That or cats, actually. And now I think about my obsession with felines and whether it came from that. Yeah. Probably did, but you know. She had changes on all the time. And she'd always tell us, Bowie had like a son, he's about your age, so mine and my sort of twin sister's age, and he's called Zoe. And we're like, Mum, no, there's no way that doesn't make sense. Why would somebody call their son Zoe? Zoe Bowie?
Yeah. Wow.
Couldn't work that out. And now it turns out that Duncan Jones, film director of Source Code and Moon, is the same Zoe Bowie. I know. I want to know about his upbringing, because it's... being film obsessive and stuff, and having read interviews with Duncan, he's...
I did see Source Code, actually. I liked that.
Yeah, I liked it. Did you see Moon?
Yeah, I really liked that. That was his first film, wasn't it?
Did you get a chance to see that, Rabia?
Oh, no, I'm not with... Not on this.
I'd recommend it, actually. Moon was a really, really good film. It's a... it's almost a chamber piece or whatever. It's just basically two people... in a room, chatting away. It would translate really well to theatre, I think, actually.
Yeah, but, I can see that, actually.
You need twins to do it, obviously, because it's about cloning and stuff. But he's done these really hard sci-fi films, and he just says it's because his dad, the original Space Oddity, was showing all these films like Blade Runner and 2001 Space Oddity because he was growing up.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know more about being the child of David Bowie, not to...
It must have been pretty out there.
Yeah, I guess. But, not to sort of dismiss anything that Duncan's done in his own right as a sort of, fully functioning adult, but, that's got to be kind of messed up, having sort of the Thin White Duke as your old man, I think.
Yeah, in fact, something from that Slash autobiography, I didn't realise, Slash is actually British.
Yeah, he's from Stoke.
His mum was like a costume maker, and they moved to LA when he was young, and she was making costume for David Bowie.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I was hanging out with him and things, so he's in that biography as well.
God.
But how did you say earlier about the book club thing? And I know you go to book club, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that. Other people introducing you to books and sharing books.
Mm. Yeah, it's been going for quite a while now, this book club. It's often ones that you wouldn't pick up yourself, necessarily go for that genre, but...
What would be the last couple that you've read?
The last one, I didn't read it because it was a bit... I found it wasn't my kind of thing, it was a bit too disturbing, but it's like... It's called Today I'm Alice by Alice Jameson.
Okay.
And it's autobiographical. And it's basically about this girl who has had multiple personality disorder.
Okay. So today she's Alice.
Yeah, today I'm Alice. And she talks about all of these voices that she's had in her head. But I only read the back and the blurb, and then I kind of looked at a few pages in the middle. But it focuses a lot on she was sexually abused by her father as a child, and it went on to talk about how she developed eating disorders, and she had all these other voices, and it was a bit intense for me. But some of the people, it was a good discussion anyway.
Yeah.
At the book club, and it just shows how you know, the girl that like that chose it, how different people responded to that choice. And it's good to, yeah, it is good to, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't so much.
Mm-hmm. In the wider group, was there anybody affected by any issues in that themselves?
No, I don't think so. Like, there, a couple of the girls that were like, who work in the mental health field, so they were naturally more intrigued by it and kind of a bit more, a bit less disturbed by it almost, because it was less shocking to them,
maybe.
Yeah. But but no, I don't think anyone's personally affected by any of those issues. Well, no one said they were.
And so what are
We tend to have a lot of kirk at these book clubs.
That's a running theme. Great excuse, yeah.
And so what else have you read from there?
The one before that was called Anansi Boys.
Okay.
And that's like a supernatural, I can't remember who it's by, but
Anansi, like the West Indian spider thing?
Yeah. I had no idea what it was about, but basically it must be about spider, because it's like talks about this guy who's the son of a god, but he's a demigod, but he doesn't kind of
he doesn't know to rock
well out. He knows that his dad's a god, but he doesn't kind of think he's got any powers, and then he's forgotten about this brother he's got, who's called Spider, who seems to have all of these powers, and he's inherited none. So then their father dies, but he's not really dead, like he can come back whenever he wants. But when his father leaves, they kind of find out about each other again, and it talks, and it kind of deals with their relationship. Uh-huh. But it is supernatural. Like, I would never, and I got that from the local library, actually. Right. I got it out, yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the local one, but it was in the district, Middlesbrough, and they were able to send it over, which was good. So it's never, like, it was supernatural, and I just thought I'd never have chosen that if it wasn't for the book club.
That's a really good way to find new books and things.
I said one I'd actually suggest to you in that case would be American Gods by Neil Gaiman.
That was the guy who wrote it.
So it's actually...
Is he a director as well?
So it's probably the same book. So it's American Gods that you read.
No, it's called Anansi Boy.
Okay. Then it's a similar story to this. But in that, you've got this guy, Shadow, who he's actually the son of Thor, or Woden, or something like that. So he's basically working out that all the old school European gods that they used to sort of worship and stuff. So like, you know, in the West Indies it would be like Anansi, or in sort of from people who come from Europe it would be like the sort of you know, the leprechauns or whatever from Ireland, or like, you know, sort of certainly like Thor, or you know, Woden from the sort of Nordic stuff. When it comes to America, people forget about sort of their gods and just become sort of consumerists. And then you've got new gods who are like the god of the internet and stuff like that. And this guy is a sort of everyman who's sort of trying to find his path, solve some murder, do some task, against the backdrop of all these gods trying to sort of get humans to worship them again, because they've lost all their power. They've got to they've followed the sort of populations as they've migrated to the new world. But the sort of populations have then forgotten them, so then they're all bums. And it's really, really sort of good. But Anansi is
isn't it funny? It made you think of that, because I'm pretty sure that's the author. Like, couldn't think of the name, but now you've said it, it does ring a bell.
It's a really, really good book, and it is sort of really good, because Anansi is a very sort of charming character in the book as well. But it's one that I actually found, since the found book, that was in my work, that had an inscription to a guy who still works at my place, whose name I don't want to mention. They moved to a different office and left loads of crap in their drawers and stuff, and one of them was this book. Yeah. Another one of them was the sequel to Catch 22, which I've got. Uh-huh. I've not read yet, because it's not as funny.
I remember finding Brave New World at Sturt Beach.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
And I do remember.
And it was quite weird, because we'd been talking about it all weekend, and then as we were leaving, there was a book lying in the grass, and I said, wouldn't it be funny if it was Brave New World?
No. And it was.
And then we walked over to it, and it was, yeah. Mm. And that had some inscription in it. It had, like, a plate from a girls' school So somebody had sort of pilfered it from their girls' school library.
Yeah, check out page 136. Yeah. It's good for a laugh. I don't know, if you like Soma.
Yeah.
Did you keep it then? Is it on your bookshelf?
Yeah, I have got it. It should be here, I think. But there is something magical about books like that as well, which is my very old-fashioned principles against the Kindle, but you just don't have the same magic. And actually, a book I read recently described it really well. It is in The White Tiger by Aravinda Diga, which I swapped for A Fine Balance with Jess, who I'm not sure where she is at the moment. But yeah, and in that he describes being in a bookstall and having buzz just from standing around all those books, and he talks as well about like the kind of secondhand books and how, you know, they all have this history like in them, like, you know, it's like a power that books have. And I think, yeah, finding books, there's always something quite serendipitous about it somehow.
Yeah, I think especially if it's something that you like. I mean,
yeah.
Actually, a really notable one for me was I should have known from how it was introduced to me. I was living in Twickenham at the time, and I was coming in the train to Waterloo, and this lady got off the train and sort of as she was getting off the train, put a book in the bin, and it was sort of first thing in the morning, so the bin didn't have any crap in it at all. So I thought, I'll fish that out because that's a book. Yeah, because you shouldn't throw away books. How could that be bad? And it was the Da Vinci Code, which I've been going into sort of Waterloo. It was on every poster, like every as you were coming in, like there were loads of sort of posters on the wall and stuff. Da Vinci Code, Da Vinci Code, Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons. So they're all Dan Brown books. So, it's sinking in, but I don't really know anything about it. So I picked it up out of the bin and read it, and I was like, yeah, that's shit. That's
every really charity bad. Shop you go into is you about four copies of Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't like the whole sort of... I mean, I do like...
Did you see that film, actually?
I did see the film on a plane and thought it was a bit shit.
I liked Audrey Tutu.
Oh, yeah, I love Audrey Tutu.
Yeah, she can't do no wrong.
Yeah. But I do think that she's her later materials, she's just trading on sort of Emily, alas. Well, oh no, the Sugar. I forget that was the name of the film.
She's done a lot of things. French ones. She's done a few French ones, hasn't she? And that she's like I heard her actually. She's on Woman's Hour on Radio 4 recently, and she's talking about how it was a real experience doing like a Hollywood blockbuster like Da Vinci Code, and she did it for the experience to work with Tom Hanks. She really like respects. She wasn't in a rush to do another Hollywood film, but I got that impression.
I'd have done it because of Ron Howard, old little Richie Cunningham. Just like, but anyway, so cheese. But Da Vinci Code, it was, I don't know, it was a book du jour, as it were. A lot of people sort of were really, really into it. I then lent it to my dad. I was like, look, Dad, have this. And he loved it, like really, really loved it. Dad, what are you doing?
A lot of people did, didn't they?
Yeah, but then he did give it to a charity shop, and you are right. And this is the thing about going.
It's not. It doesn't seem to be a book that people want to hold on to. Yeah. I mean, I've got books
not at all.
I'd never give away. You know.
Yeah. So
lend them out.
Yeah, lend them out. Yeah. Only to people I know would appreciate them. That's the thing, isn't it? It's quite exciting lending people books as well. Mm. So you have this whole like, I really want you to read this, and
so we can discuss it.
Like,
as with Rabia's book club.
So what are you reading at the moment? How often do you meet?
So it's meant to be every month, but it's not super strict.
Yeah.
But the book at the moment I chose it, and it's a graphic novel called Palestine, entitled Palestine by Joe Sacco, and basically like he visited Gaza and the West Bank in the early 90s, and I've been reading it today on the train actually, coming down here. It's good, it's really good. Like, it's basically, it's just from what I read so far, it's very like just observational, and there's no real it's a very different viewpoint. It's just basically, like, I've always wanted to go to the West Bank or to Gaza and just see what it's like firsthand, yeah. While it's set in the 90s, actually, in the time, around the time of the Second Intifada.
So is that you actually being in sort of Arafat sort of era?
Yeah, PLO time.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's just like talking about different places he's gone and experiences he's had and people he's spoken with. And it's just very like, that doesn't seem to be a storyline really, it's just experience, it's like a travel journal almost, but like, it's the comic style.
But which illustrated.
Yeah, it's all illustrated. And so far I'm really enjoying it. And I hope everyone gets it and reads it, like in the club. And so we can have, I think it'll be good for discussion.
So how was it sort of originally done? Was this done as an actual comic or was it sort of done as published as a book
No, originally it was, he published it in 9 issues as comics. Yeah. But this is the first, I think it was published as a whole a lot later. I can get it out, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly when, but it was like probably about a decade later it was originally published as the entirety.
And this is the first graphic novel that you've read?
It is, actually, yeah. It's not really the kind of thing I usually go for, and we've never had that at book club before. Yeah. And my sister, I proofread an essay for her. She did international politics degree, and she wrote about this comic, and I found it really interesting. So I thought, since it was my turn to choose something, I thought it's a bit different, it's something I'd wanted to read anyway, and also, it's been good for discussion. I think it's always important for book clubs.
Yeah, I think it's strange, actually. I mean, you think these days, you know, certainly with film, Hollywood plunders comics. And, you know, you have, like, the really sort of the superhero crap that's out. But then you have things like Persepolis, which was...
Yeah, I really wanted to read that, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, they made the film of it, didn't they? Yeah. I think I've actually got it somewhere, but I've not watched it.
And, well, of course, when it's such a literal sort of animation sort of thing, then it is the same frames from it and stuff.
Yeah. But
there's a real sort of thing that you know, people can put away a lot, can put across a lot of, not sort of subversive, but a lot of sort of really deep and meaningful things in that form that's. I don't know, it's not normal. Well, yeah, your conventional thing would be text. And you think, I mean, did he have sort of, I don't know, like a dyslexia or anything like that? Or, do you know of?
Did he do what, sorry?
Did he have dyslexia at any point?
Did he have, the writer?
Yeah.
The author? I don't know, I don't think so.
Because there's a thing I've been hearing recently of people who, certainly sort of film directors and the like, that... sort of, you've got sort of Nicholas Winding Refn, who is purely visual because he only learned to read when he was 13.
Wow.
And it's that thing of sort of comic book sort of things where you're putting across pretty heavy concepts in the sort of, you know, sort of drawn form, so illustrated form, because text wouldn't be the sort of first mode of communication. And that sort of fascinates me. I don't know. Yeah. In fact, Ravi has just handed over a copy of the Palestine by Joe
really
Sacco.
Nice illustrations.
Yeah, it's really, really detailed.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we're going to have to tweet links to this because it's very, very much very visceral.
Yeah.
It's depiction of events. Sort of non. It's there's a lot of cells. Which have the sort of bit going on, but then whole pages just have a single message on it, broken down.
Big text.
Yeah.
Every huge image.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's
it looks amazing.
Very much like Alfred Bester in terms of realizing how sort of text can be used in sort of different typography and sort of sizes and stuff.
To become a graphic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent stuff.
So I suppose that was like, it wasn't a direct recommendation, but I took it as well when I read the essay, because clearly my sister enjoyed it, and I'd recommend it from what I read so far.
I would say actually, yeah, I'm going to sort of flag this. Rabia's got the receipt as a bookmark.
Mm.
And
that's nice.
Yeah, that's very nice, but it's quite sort of topical for myself, because last night I watched Brighton Rock, the new sort of Roland Joffe sort of take on the sort of Graham Greene book. And it was also filmed in the sort of 40s with Dickie Attenborough. And I just because I was watching it and stuff, I grabbed my copy of it. And because I was just basically checking characters out against it, but I was looking through it. And yeah, my bookmark was my flight ticket, my boarding pass.
That's nice, yeah.
Yeah, well, I bought it at the airport and stuff. And it's just really odd because it does just instantly take you back. So that's really good that the receipt.
Got your dates there. And it's
quite nice. That's with the receipt. So the receipt will tell you where you were when you sort of bought it and stuff. Mm. And that's a great thing when you find that in secondhand books, when, like, you know, whoever it was.
It's a little piece of that book's history, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, snapshot.
It's really odd when you get the sort of, I mean, I've bought books and stuff where, like, there'll be a train ticket and it'll be somewhere, like, you know, in deepest, fucking darkest Scotland and stuff. There'll be a train ticket in there, like, some routes are sort of Argyle or something. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
This, yeah, like, in fact, the one that I bought, it had, like, it was British Rail, like, before it was all nationalised and stuff. No, before it was all privatised and stuff.
Mm.
Ancient, like, 80s. And, I don't know, it really sets you back. It gives you sort of a real sense of the original owner of the book and the history of the whoever bought it and stuff. Yeah.
It just hits home how long that's been around and it was enjoyed at that time, you know, all those years ago, and it's like, it's kind of come alive again, really.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I find the ones that are far more hitting is when you've got, like, birthday inscriptions, and that's just like, why would somebody have passed on a birthday gift? And then it makes you think, oh, God, are they still around, the original owner of the book? Or is this just something they've lent to somebody and it went into circulation? Yeah. I don't know.
It's interesting.
It's a story in itself. And that's the beauty of it. That I think certainly, I mean, the Kindle thing is definitely convenient.
Yeah. No, I can see the attraction.
But I think it's probably good for, like, course texts and things like that. You know, that you don't
And also the travelling with. You can carry however many
thousands of books. Yeah, you can carry thousands of books in one go. Yeah.
I think I'm a bit of an old-fashioned one on this as well.
I was saying earlier, just this thing from just holding a book and just being around books that you don't get, even if you had a whole library full of Kindles, I don't think it would be the same.
I mean, the same thing you could say, you know, certainly my parents had wall-to-wall vinyl and stuff, and it was great seeing it vinyl and stuff.
See, that's somewhere else I'm quite old-fashioned as well.
So you didn't sort of, you know, from the sort of 90s and stuff, it's all CDs, and admittedly, my parents were late adopters.
MP3 player.
See, that's when it gets really, really impersonal, when you're looking at playlists on someone's computer instead of, like, you know, some physical thing. And I don't know, as much as I like this sort of convenience of online like that, I think a physical copy, if anything, is more secure. You could lose a computer.
That's true.
To lose a book, well, you could lose a book. Of course you can. I'm sure I've
and
done
if
that.
And if the poles reverse and there's an electromagnetic field, then all the computers will be wiped.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, at the moment I'm reading... It's not exactly a borrowed book, but it was a recommendation. And it's called Perfume by Daniel Susskind.
I've seen the film, but I know.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen the film, but I'd quite like to. It's it's
the unfilmable book was made into a film.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, reading it, I can't imagine how you could make it into a film, because so much of it is about describing smells. And I think, it would be a challenge, definitely, to show you that on the screen.
Oh, yeah, and how are you enjoying that? I mean, how is it sort of...
I'm actually really getting into it.
Have you noticed that everyone he leaves dies?
Horribly? No, I haven't noticed that yet. now I do that you say that. It's a bit...
Yeah, everybody dies.
Yeah, no, I read that bit where the first wet nurse that he went to, who just wanted to die kind of on her own, like privately, end up in this... bed with five other women or something, and it's pretty grim. But a lot of it's described, like, through the smells and things, and it's I'm not sure what the word. It's very tactile somehow. It really, think by describing smells, it really puts that image in your head, and it's kind of like a smell, it lingers as well, and there's something quite disturbing about that.
Well, there's a thing actually, sort of, in terms of something borrowed, or adaptation sort of aspect, if you can spin that out. Stanley Kubrick loved the book, the book, but didn't option it because he just saw it as completely unfilmable, as a sort of thing of how can you convey the smell, or how can you convey this sort of level of detail that it goes into, because if you know nothing of perfume, it's said in a sort of... God, when is
it? It's like 17th ago, century it? France, is it? Or no, probably 19th century France, early 19th century.
To a point where, yeah.
It's around the time of the revolution, maybe late 18th century.
But you've got a lot of, sort of privies and stuff, and sort of waste buckets being thrown out into the streets, and just grim smells, and that's but the thing.
Really, sort of paints this picture of this dirty Paris that just reeks of every awful, like, rotting smell.
Yeah,
it's very good.
I don't know. Yeah, I'd say check out the film if you read the book, because I'd like to know what you think of it.
Yeah.
And I'm really, to go back to the film sort of aspect and stuff of adaptations, Cloud Atlas, did you get a chance to read it?
No, but David Mitchell.
Yeah.
That's a book I keep seeing everywhere.
That's a book?
I've not read.
This Da Vinci Code sort of zeitgeist thing that was mentioned before, whatever. But, you know, this sort of Cloud Atlas is genuinely a book that everybody should read.
Mm.
It's a masterclass of style and technique, but also editing style as well. So the way he writes, it's six stories over different time periods. Every protagonist in the story is somehow reading a journal or watching a thing or doing something that was of the previous journal. So as you're reading it, when you get to the next book, someone's actually just reading a diary, which is what you've just read. And so it just transports you along and along and along. And it's an absolute masterclass because it starts off in the sort of, 1800s, goes through to the distant future, it's like sort of post-apocalyptic future, and then goes back. So it starts off with similar to sort of Dracula, Jonathan Harker's diary, or whatever like that. One of them's a journal entry, so it's written like a diary. Next bit is, you know, this a series of letters. Mm-hmm. So it's basically some guy writing to his implied lover that he doesn't really sort of make clear.
Okay.
The next one, where it's the implied lover, is a sort of espionage, sort of a paranoid 70s thriller in a sort of vein of like the conspiracy, the conversation, sorry.
Uh-huh.
Sort of, Francis Ford Coppola film considered to Gene Hackman. It's like that sort of thing. Then it skips to, the future. It skips to the 80s and stuff, and then it skips to the future. And every time, so the sort of later books are like sci-fi books where it's really clinical, William Gibson style sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, so you've got sort of six books in one anyway, in terms of style, with a really, really, really mashed up editing sort of technique. And Tom Tyker, the guy who did Perfume, is directing the film.
Oh, right.
Adapting the sort of book to the film. And the future stuff is going to be directed by the Wachowskis, who did The Matrix. So... Definitely one to sort of keep your eye out. It'll probably be out next year with an all-star cast playing multiple roles. And
massive budget.
Not actually. It's the most expensive German film of all time because Tom Tyker's German stuff. That's why Perfume's sort of European production and stuff. But it's fascinating when you have these sort of real auteurs adapting books, which is in a sort of, I mentioned Kubrick before for Perfume and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, he did like The Shining, Clockwork Orange, even Full Metal Jacket's based in the book, as is 2001 Space Odyssey. You know, all these things are based on books that he did films of. Barry Lyndon, same thing. And it's just great seeing that sort of, reinterpretation or whatever, of literature. sort of taking one form and transforming it into a visual form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, that was a good discussion, I think. Well done thinking up the something borrowed theme.
Yeah, I don't know. It was quite topical, I guess, because the Guardian's promotion and stuff.
I don't know if what we're going to do. We're going to break and maybe play a tune.
Yeah. Coming up, we've got Real Nas T. He's a sort of South West London based MC from the UK. And yeah, this is his track. Over to you, Stevie B. So, yeah, that was Real Nas T. Thank you very much, Stephen Barrow.
Wicked tune.
But yeah, anyway, coming up next month. In fact, so have you got any recommendations for the month at all?
Well, this weekend I'm looking forward to going to some stuff that's on around Design Week. There's a Lego conservatory. One in Covent Garden.
Oh, yeah, I'd say, yeah.
Actually, I'm getting a bit confused because by the time this show goes out, it will actually be last weekend.
Well, I'd say if you get the chance to see it from Friday onwards, then definitely get down to Covent Garden early evening to see the Lego glass house lit up when it's going to really be in its element.
And got some recommendations from Ellen, our erstwhile presenter. Going next week with her to the Boom Boom Club in the Old Vic Tunnels of by Waterloo.
Of course,
It's a kind of cabaret night, I think, from what was saying earlier. But I think it's supposed to be quite surreal and a little bit off the wall. And an old friend of the show, Rebecca Delgado, who's been in to play in the studio a couple of times, is playing on the bill that night.
So, of course, the Old Vic Tunnels, that'd be the Kevin Spacey offshoot from the Old Vic.
Okay.
So, yeah, definitely right, worth it. Sort of, get down there for anything, actually. Check out those tunnels.
Yeah, it should be a really cool venue.
But also, there's Fuel Theatres sort of stuff. In fact, we're going to be tweeting the link later. But there's some very cool things going on fueltheatre.com/projects/everydaymoments. It's the latest from Melanie Wilson, who's someone that we like a lot.
And just reading a bit off the website there, imagine there was a soundtrack to all those small moments when you find yourself alone, brushing your teeth in the bath, watching the rain stream down your living room window, when you're locked up in bed and able to sleep. And it's a series of podcasts it's created especially for you to enjoy in a particular time and place. They're going to be released, these podcasts, one a month throughout 2011. So, again, we'll be tweeting the link to that. So check that out. That's Everyday Moments, part of Fuel Theatre.
Also, another one a bit left field, one that you might want to sort of get involved in. It's Terrace Season, and that's at terraceseason.com. Check it out. You may be surprised. But other than that, my other recommendation would be check out Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Because it's going to be Gary Oldman and an all-star British cast, like doing their best sort of a John le Carré adaptation. One of the sort of highlights of this time of year's cinema releases.
Excellent.
Cool. Thank you very much, Rabia, for contributing earlier on. And cool.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay. That's Dan and I backwards September over and out. Thanks for listening.
See you next month.
Good night.